Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by DigitalOcean. Simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. And by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/C101. That's lynda.com/C101. On this wildcard episode of Coding 101, we've got Ryan Clark lost from DEF CON. Hello and welcome to Coding 101. It's the TWiT show where we let you into the wonderful world of the code warrior / code monkey. I'm Father Robert Palliser, the digital Jesuit, and guiding you along with me is my super special co-host, Mr. Lou Maresca, a senior software lead at Microsoft. Lou, my friend, it is always good to see you. Welcome back to Coding 101.
Yeah, amazing to see you. Thanks for having me back.
We do these wild card episodes every once in a while as sort of a palate cleanser. So we've spent some time doing a module. We were talking about PowerShell, and now we want to go from coding and from the actual process of putting together something in computer science to speaking to the people who make it interesting, speaking to the people who we find fascinating. And we've got a doozy for you, a man who I've been wanting to speak to for a while. I've seen him many, many years at DEF CON in Las Vegas, the premier hacker conference security conference. We'll call it a security conference. Lost. That's right. Ryan Clark. If you've ever been to a show in Las Vegas, you know him as the person behind the art, behind the soul, behind the crypto challenge, behind the badges of DEF CON. Ryan, thank you very much for coming on to Coding 101.
Nate, thanks for having me.
Now, I will say that's the last time we're going to be calling you Ryan until we get to the end of the show, because everyone who's ever been to DEF CON just calls you Lost. Where did you get that name?
So that's kind of an evolution, actually. I started out as Lost Boy, which had three different origin stories, so to speak. One is the obvious, the Lost Boys movie from the 80s. I love it. It's horrible, I know, but it's still a great flick as far as I'm concerned. When I was in high school band, we also played a piece of music called Little Boy Lost Pieces of Dreams. And the other reason is private, which I won't share. So Lost Boy actually kind of got truncated to Lost, and then Lost got flipped into 1057 after the first mystery challenge.
And as you can see on your lower third, 1057 gets converted into binary, and you've actually, of all the people I know at DEF CON, you probably have the most aliases.
I have been called a number of things, some of them kind of profane based on how frustrated people are with my contests at the time, but I kind of went with 1057 when I realized that it was a palindrome in binary, and it kind of fit with some of the puzzle pieces that I was doing for the mystery challenge that year.
We are going to jump into that. You spoke a little bit about the mystery challenge, and yes, I have heard your name taken in vain way more than once or twice or a dozen times. Normally every year, right about the second day, after the excitement of your challenge wears off, people really start calling you bad things. But we'll get into that. Before we do that, I want to talk about you before DEF CON. I want to talk about what brought you to prominence in that community. Where did you grow up, and what was your first exposure to technology?
So I've been a tech geek my whole life. I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in computers, but I'm old enough that, unlike many of the younger guys in the scene now, not everybody had a computer when I was a kid growing up, and it was very unusual. My first computer was actually a Sinclair 1000. Wow. With a 16K memory pack that Velcroed to the back. And I was in, I think, third grade. I actually wrote some code for the Sinclair 1000. And I remember how annoying it was, because for those of you who've ever used one, you know that the amount of RAM was so sparse that the video frame buffer didn't have enough horsepower to actually allow typing as well as display at the same time. So they would it would flash every time you tried to type on it because the screen was refreshing each time you hit a key. So I graduated from that and went to the love of my life, computer-wise, which I still have, which is the Commodore 64. And then I went from the Commodore to an IBM PC Junior, and then it just was all downhill from there.
Oh, the Junior, that wonderful stopgap of what were they thinking?
Yeah.
I will say I had a Sinclair myself, and it was a junk computer. I had salvaged it out of four different ones I found in a dumpster here in the Silicon Valley. And I did manage to get that memory module that would snap onto the back. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, this is all the memory I'll ever need now. I think it upgraded it to, was it 4K? Literally, I think it was just 4K. And I had hooked up to a car battery, and that was my earliest portable computer.
Yeah, my mom used to ask me why I didn't have normal sleepovers. We had computer parties when I was a kid instead of sleepovers, and my friends would bring their computers. Unfortunately, back in the day, when everything was done over modem with acoustic coupler, we had to take turns with the phone line. But we used to get together, and Mom thought we were just playing games, but we were doing stuff like trying to break into CompuServe and stuff like that.
Right.
So,
when you had your early pieces of hardware, was it how did you come by it? How did you get that early gear?
So our first Sinclair 1000 was actually given to us by a friend of the family. My family didn't have a whole lot of money when I was growing up. And we had a family friend who was very into tech, but also into encouraging kids. And so he actually gave the Sinclair to my brother and I, as well as our first Commodore. And I remember being so just in awe of the fact that somebody would be so kind, and it really affected and shaped the rest of my life. I remember actually getting in trouble with my father because in addition to that, we did have a couple of the old Atari consoles. We had the 2600 and then later Atari consoles. And I was interested in how they worked, and I didn't want to take the computer apart because I didn't want to destroy it and not have it to be able to use. But I remember taking apart the Atari and not being able to put it back together at that time because of my age and I didn't have the right tools or anything. And I got in a lot of trouble with my parents because I had destroyed the Atari.
I think that's a common origin story for a lot of geeks, which is we started by taking things apart. I mean, we needed to know how it worked if we were going to start building things. And so I would take things apart and I would put them in different boxes, different cases, and different combinations. And it was kind of like I made something, even though I really just disassembled and then got working enough to call it something else. But I want to go back to that feeling you got when someone gave you this computer. Did you know a lot about the computer revolution before you got that computer, or was that really your first entree into that world?
I like a lot of subjects that I'm interested in, I had read a lot about computers. I constantly read. And I had read about programming, and I had read about all these things, and it was very exciting to me, but it was this world that I didn't have access to at the time. When we got that first computer, it really opened that door. But I had been obsessed with technology pretty much from birth, as far as I can remember. I don't remember a time that I wasn't interested in tech.
That's interesting, because we have spoken with a few of our guests here on the show about this idea of foundational knowledge. And I think it was easier for people of a past generation, because we would start without the technology. Like you, I used to dream about having a computer or having something like a program, something that looked so futuristic. But we didn't really have it. And so when I did get it, I wanted to learn everything about it. I wanted to learn about how the ICs worked. I wanted to learn how the logic worked. In a lot of ways, that's more difficult for someone growing up today, because anyone born after 1986 grew up not just with computers, but with the internet. They've never not had it. Do you think it's easier to have that foundational knowledge than to start with, I have everything, and if I have time, I'll learn how it works?
It's funny you should say that, because one of the talks that I give at DEF CON every year is the DEF CON 101 track, and it's kind of a foundational knowledge dump that I give. And part of my frustration with people, both people new to the scene who want to come in and learn and become a hacker or a tinker, as well as when I was teaching at the university, I don't see younger generation kids tinkering as much anymore. And I don't know if it's because they've just grown up with the instant gratification of Google, or if they feel like any knowledge that they need to have can be backfilled instantly at any time. So they don't feel a need to have that foundation to go off of because they think it's like a time sink. And I have this rant that I give every year at DEF CON about the whole phrase thinking outside the box and how it's bupkis. Because in order to have those epiphanal moments, you have to have that foundational knowledge. And a lot of research and study has been done that shows that it's not just somebody coming in and coming down from on high and giving you the knowledge of, hey, you can draw outside the box with these lines and breaking those paradigms. It's actually long-term exposure in that foundational knowledge that gives people the depth in order to have those aha moments and those breakthroughs. And I think in some ways we're kind of missing that. And for this generation, I'm actually kind of sad for them. I was an oddity as a kid because I was the geek that was interested in electronics and computers. And back then there was very much a separation between those social groups. And now everyone has a computer, everyone has a cell phone. And so even the kids that are predisposed to be the tech geek types like I was, they're not as, I don't want to say special or segregated. I don't know what the right word is, but they're thrown into a category that's really all not that. You know, it's geek chic now. I mean, we've got ThinkGeek that sells how many millions of dollars worth of products every day. And back in the day, if you had a computer, you had to seek that out. It took effort and it took tenacity in order to get a foundational knowledge. And these days, it's served up to you on Google.
So, Lost, now that we have your, you know, how you got into computers and you know, hardware, can you tell us what was the first programming language you did and how'd you get into it?
So the first language obviously was BASIC. Because of what I was doing. Well, besides the Sinclair stuff, I was too young at the time to have an appreciation for like the separation and knowing what assembly was. The first, what I would call real computer program that I wrote, I would probably say I was in high school because up until that point, everything that I had done was copying codes I had out of magazines and out of books. And it was mostly BASIC or Logo, you know, moving the turtle around on the screen, that kind of thing. But when I was in high school, I was kind of interested in a certain young lady who was in the high school band, and I wasn't in the band at that point. So the summer between my sophomore and junior year of high school, I went to a music store and I bought a fingering chart for the trumpet because I knew that the trumpet section sat behind the flautist, which she happened to be. And I actually wrote software on my PC Junior that would quiz me and teach me both to read the music and even with the pathetic little PC speaker, play the note. And so I wrote software that I ran on myself all that summer. And it worked well enough that by the time my junior year ran around, I was able to make third chair trumpet and actually get to that position where I was sitting behind where this young lady was. Unfortunately, sad ending to that story, that was the year that she had decided she was going to become a foreign exchange student and went away to Germany, and I never saw her again. So...
So it was your in, though. She got you into programming. That was great.
Well, I was interested in it before then. I just didn't really know what I was doing. I had never like picked something and said, I'm going to code for this. And then from there, it was all downhill. Because once I realized, hey, I really can make something useful, it's not just tinkering at this point, I got really into it. And from there, I graduated into doing stuff with different microcontrollers like the 68HC11 and other stuff. So.
Let me ask about that tinkering, because that's my favorite part. I still do that. That every day after I'm done here at the studio, I'll go home and at least for an hour or two, I'm tinkering either with my quadcopters, with some ICs, with my 3D printer. There's a lot of that has been lost, and we hear this from the audience all the time because they want to know how they get into computer science, how they get. And the undertone is, I want to get into this as a career. Because I see there's a lot of money to be made in programming to make the latest app that will sell for $1 billion. And that's, I mean, that's not a bad thing. But at the same time, I'm always thinking that's the wrong way to approach it. Because if you don't like to tinker, if you don't like that process that you just talked about of coming in to have an appreciation for coding silly things, I don't know if you get the same love for CS and for EE.
Yeah, so I take software and hardware in two different angles. Hardware, we're kind of taught not to experiment with hardware. It's dangerous. It's expensive. You'll ruin it. And software, to some extent, we're now putting fear into this younger generation. Like, there's viruses and there's bad people out there and you're going to get owned. And so it's kind of like we've instilled this fear into the younger generation to where they don't tinker anymore. I mean, a compiler is free. You can compile as many times as you want. But when I was teaching at the university, one of the biggest frustrations for me was when a student would come to me and ask a question, and I always responded first with, "Have you tried it?" And it was amazing to me how many of them had not actually tried what the question was that they were asking. And I would say, "I don't know the answer. Go try it. Figure it out yourself." Because I wanted them to get the experience of having the confidence, you know, it's okay to fail. It's okay to have something not compile. It's okay to have something crash. That's part of the process. But everyone is so afraid of that process now. They want everything to be perfect and work the first time. And now we have such great tools. I mean, the compiler is going to help you through coding issues anyway. But I'm just surprised at how many people, they'd come up and I would be teaching a C class and they would say, you know, does such and such work in this way? And I was like, go test it. Have you tried it? Have you done a test case? And it still just blew me away how many of them, and these were smart kids that would rather, and it goes back to the having Google thing, would rather go seek out that information from a source that they know have it rather than through experimentation get that knowledge for themselves. And it's really because we've taught them that from as they've grown up, that now all you have to do is search certain databases or places and you'll get the answer instead of going and finding it for yourself.
Right. All right, so now that we know how you got started programming and what motivated you to go deeper, can you tell us a little bit about what your first experience hacking was?
My first experience hacking was probably the computer parties that I mentioned before, where my friends and I would take our modems and we would do basically, we didn't know it was called this at the time, but we would basically war dial looking for systems. And back then, it was difficult. We would get the Computer Shopper magazine and we would find BBSs that we could connect to. I did have some friends that went down the road of the carding and the freaking and stuff like that. And I was always, I wasn't interested in the criminal aspect of it. I was just interested how the systems worked and how I could abuse the rules of the system. Not so much for how, oh, I'm being anarchistic. I'm bringing chaos into the world like some folks. But more of just, I was interested in how things worked. And when you pull it apart, you know, abusing those systems is how you figure out how they work.
Right.
You know, Loss, there is a lot of interesting stories there that we could take from an entire generation of, I know the millennial generation won't understand this, but the people of us, those of us who grew up with modems, who had to sit there for 3-4 minutes while the thing connected, we had a favorite BBS or two, and especially those who ever did a war dialing. No, not war driving, but a war dialing. There was a lot of wonderment back then because these were brand new systems. We had no idea what they were really capable of. And I remember the first hacking things that me and my friends would do, it was never about finding information that you could sell. It was never about breaking things. It was always about, oh, look what I could do. Look where I could get into.
Exactly. In fact, if you look at the phone freaker generation, which was necessary at the time, it's because we were all dependent on modems. You had to do freaking in order to get your free long distance, in order to connect to your friends who were across the country and in other countries. So that, I mean, it was a natural progression that phone freaking was tied very closely to the hacker community. And still to this day, you know, a lot of my close friends in the community are from the phone freaking stuff that we used to do so that you could reach out and touch each other or on BBSs.
Right, right. But it always feels like there's a little bit of a disconnect there because I grew up thinking that this was the greatest thing ever, that these people who I sat with at the computer club or the local computer swap group, we were showing each other tricks just to say, oh, look what you could do. And that's really been lost. I think nowadays, if you're trying to discover a vulnerability, either you're a security researcher or you're a black hat, and you get lumped into one or the other, and there's not a whole lot of space in the middle for just people who are curious. That's actually one of the things that I really like about DEF CON. That's what I love about the hardware hacking village. But we'll get back to that. let's get a bit more into your past. Specifically, there's an interesting bit of your history where you had an uncle who was a deputy director of the FBI.
That's correct.
And again, remember, if I start to get into things that you're not supposed to talk about, just smile. But how much did his career and what you saw in his life, how much did that affect your decision to start turning this interest in computer science and programming and a budding interest in hacking into more of a career choice rather than just a tinker time?
So, yeah. So Uncle Floyd was assistant director of the Bureau, and then ultimately he was acting director for a while. My first exposure to what that really meant was when I was in sixth grade, I was in a thing called the Olympics of the Mind. I don't know if that's even still around. And my team, I was on two different projects. One was we built a car that ran on a hydraulic jack, and there was a computer problem, which was done on the Commodore 64. And both of my teams that I was on made it to the, what we called it the World Finals, but since it was only in the U.S., it was really just Nationals. And I got to go from Arizona, which is where I'm from originally, to Washington, D.C. And at that point, because Uncle Floyd was there and had been moving up the ranks in the Bureau, he got my team into the J. Edgar Hoover building, and they walked us around, and they took us down and showed us some of the guns that they have in the basement of the Hoover building and stuff like that. But I something that really stuck with me, I was always curious because Uncle Floyd couldn't talk about a lot of the stuff that he did. And I didn't really understand, you know, at the time, because I was so young, why that was. But he said something that just always kind of stuck with me. And he said, if you ever go into any type of federal career like this, you have to be the type of person that gets your internal accolades or your internal your feeling of success and accomplishment privately. You have to get it of yourself because you're not going to be able to talk about the things that you do. And you're not going to be able to share it with others, including family members a lot of time. And so that made a big impression on me. And ironically, immediately after returning home from visiting Uncle Floyd at the J. Edgar Hoover building, a friend of mine who was running a BBS at the time that was hosting a bunch of carding and freaking stuff behind the door games, if you remember those, his house was actually raided and they took his computer. So it was this really bizarre juxtaposition of I had just been in the J. Edgar Hoover building, and then a friend of mine was having his computer taken away, even though he was just a kid in high school. And my name was on some of his logs and because I had accounts on his BBS. And it was very surreal. And I remember going to my parents and telling my parents that my friend had been busted and that the Bureau had taken his stuff. And it was just very strange having just come from the J. Edgar Hoover building and having that happen.
We're speaking with Lost, the mastermind behind the mystery challenge, the crypto challenge at DEF CON. We'll be right back to talk more with him. We're going to ask him about his journey into math and into crypto. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the first sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. Now, if you're a developer, at some point, you're going to want to put your app, your service, whatever it might be, online. You're going to want to get it out into the world. And you're going to want to choose a solution that's scalable. So you could start small and then continue into a global development and a global distribution if that's what it's going to be. Oh, the old way to do it would be to stand up your own server, make sure that you've got a colo, that you set up the proper relationships with your ISP, maybe a payments processor, to make sure that everything's taken care of. And then you have to maintain the server in order to make sure that everything stays up and running, because, of course, that server is now your business. Yeah, you could still do it that way, but why when you've got DigitalOcean to help you deploy? Now, DigitalOcean uses droplets. It's a very simple idea. It's encapsulating your app, your service, and allowing it to run on everything from a single core on a single server all the way up to a globally distributed network. DigitalOcean is built by developers, for developers, and it's used by over 400,000 of them, including me. I use it whenever I want to test out something and, say, push it out to three or four friends to see how it will handle real-world traffic. I ask them to throw a couple of, interesting tricks of the trade against it to see if maybe my security will fail. Once I know it's up and running, a single click, and I'm live, and I'm ready to go out to the world. You can deploy and configure your droplets via a streamlined control panel or a simple API, and you get to choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. You get a one-click install to quickly deploy apps like Django, Docker, Drupal, LAMP, GitLab, MediaWiki, Node.js, WordPress, Ghost, Magento, OwnCloud, Ruby on Rails, and more. And all their servers are built on hex core machines with dedicated ECC memory, RAID SSD storage, up to 20 CPUs, 64 gigabytes of memory, and 640 gigabytes of SSD RAID space. Now, it's also highly scalable to meet the demands of your rapidly growing application or business. And their auto backups and snapshots take away one of the least favorite parts of administration. They take care of the backups, and instead, you just get to resize your droplets as you grow. You can deploy servers in regions all around the world with gigabit speeds, 99.99% uptime, and a full-featured DNS management panel that gives you dedicated IPs if you need them. They've got an extremely active community, which is undoubtedly my favorite part. There are people like you who use this service, and they've got problems just like you, and they post the answers to their problems. Well, it's probably the best way to learn, and it's the best way to deploy your app or your service. It's so easy to get started. You could deploy your own SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. I really don't know why you wouldn't at least give DigitalOcean a try. Right now, DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing with servers starting at just $5 per month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it easy for you to get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code C101 for a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do for you. That's DigitalOcean.com, DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, enter the code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Coding 101. We're speaking with the Lost Boy himself, who has been explaining how he got into the world of computer science, into the world of technology, and ultimately into the world of security. Now, Lost, we're going to start to make that DEF CON transition. You're a polymath. You are incredibly adept at numbers and crypto. Where did that come from?
I've always had an interest in languages and communication, both computer and spoken. And part of my philosophy has always been that if I'm going to study a language, I want to learn the foundation of that language. For example, if you're going to study a Romance language, you study Latin. If you're going to study an Asian language, like Korean or Japanese, you need to study some classical Chinese. To me, math was the language of science. Math was the foundation that all of these other disciplines were built upon. In fact, if you look at computers, for the longest time, the reason we had the computers that we did were due to the mathematicians. Yet, if you went to an average university back in the day, it was always the math department who had the least powerful computer and the worst setup. And I always found that interesting. But I knew that foundationally, ultimately, I mean, everybody says, yes, I know a computer uses binary. But how many people really know what that means? How many really understand that? I mean, everyone compare it back. The yes, I know binary is ones and zeros. Okay, how do I take a one and a zero and make a CPU out of that? How does that happen? And in order to do that, you have to have a foundation in a lot of different disciplines. And so that, and I get bored every 3 to 5 years and kind of reinvent myself with the stuff that I look at. So that's kind of how the math thing happened. I've always just been fascinated with numbers.
Fascination of numbers is fantastic. But when did you get the inkling that this was something that you could do professionally? Because, it's easy to look at crypto now and say, okay, some of the greatest minds, some of the brightest people are doing crypto. But it wasn't too long ago that crypto was something that was relegated to the bottom of the math building. It was geeks who never saw sunlight. What pushed you in that direction saying, I bet this would be something my mind would be good at?
So I started out as an undergraduate in electrical engineering because I had been interested in the electronics side of things. And I got to my senior year and didn't want to leave school because I enjoy learning so much. I actually changed my major, and I changed my major to computer science at that point. I went all the way through the curriculum for the computer science degree, got to the senior level again, and changed my major to mathematics at that point, at which point my parents said that if you don't graduate and get a degree, then you're cut off. So I had been basically through the entire EE program, the entire CS program, and mathematics was kind of this bridge, because I saw this disconnect between the programmers and the hardware guys. And I knew that eventually, coming down the pike, that there has to be somebody who can be the translator, so to speak, the guy that sits in the middle of the coder and the hardware guy. And that's kind of where I wanted to go. And it turned out that in order to facilitate that type of communication, you had to be adept at crypto, because when you talk about software and hardware, you're talking about buses and you're talking about data flowing across the system. And in order to make those systems secure, you're talking crypto at that point. And so I knew very early on, I recognized that there was going to be a need both at the time and later. I knew coming down the pike that as communication continued to increase through computers, that cryptography was going to become more and more important, and still is. And it's funny that you mention that, because I see too many coders who take security as an afterthought. And I think it's really a crime with the way universities are teaching programming, that it's kind of like a meat factory, and we're not teaching a proper mindset as far as security is concerned. And a lot of the problems that we have today wouldn't exist if we had better secure coding practices.
Right. So, okay, so now that we know, you know, how you got in and how you got involved with crypto and how we got to math, can you take us a little bit into DEF CON? Like, for instance, can you tell us what DEF CON is?
So DEF CON is one of the largest and longest running security conferences. You also have like CCC, and there are a few others who've been around a little bit longer. But it's considered by many to be the premier conference as far as hacking and security is concerned, at least here in the United States. It's kind of the after party originally of Black Hat. Both Black Hat and DEF CON were created by Jeff Moss, who's a good friend of mine, the Dark Tangent. And so now DEF CON every year attracts between 15 to 25,000 people, and it continues to grow every single year. And every year we're just blown away by the number of people, both who come from overseas and from all over the country. To me, it's kind of like the pilgrimage. If you're going to be in security and you're going to be a hacker, you really have to go to DEF CON. You have to say you've been at least once. Now there's a conference about every weekend. It wouldn't be hard to go to a security conference every weekend of the year at this point. And there I am with my my green lab coat, which is an homage to the Mystery Science Theater guys, by the way, if you're familiar. So what DEF CON was for me when I first decided I was going to go was I needed to go and prove myself. It was kind of the I need to test myself against some of these other guys, because I had basically at that point all the security stuff I was doing in isolation, because there were a lot of tech geeks and there were a lot of coders and there were a lot of other folks around, but not security minded people that really wanted to look at security as the main focus of what they were doing. And I was interested in embedded system security, and I was interested in hardware hacking and all these other things. Yeah, there's the NinjaTel fan. I think I still have my NinjaTel phone, actually. I remember when that van drove in, the hotel security was not too happy when the big antenna went up on that van. So DEF CON for me has now, for many, many years, just been an incredibly large part of my life, because of the stuff that I do takes almost an entire year's worth of planning to get done and done correctly. And now I've got so many people counting on it. I mean, the biggest compliment I've ever been paid are when people come to DEF CON and they tell me the only reason I came to DEF CON this year was to compete in your challenges. And to me, that's the payback for me for all of the work that I do, because it's all volunteer work for me. It's not a job. It's not something that I do to make money. It's a labor of love of giving back to the community.
So what was your first DEF CON?
DEF CON 9.
And then you kind of went to get into embedded system security and hardware hacking, and you wanted to basically compare yourself to some of the other people there. What was what kind of motivated you to kind of go to that very first DEF CON?
So anybody who had been studying about hacking knows about DEF CON, and I just never really had the opportunity to go. And so I had decided I was going to go and I was going to compete in a contest and I was going to win. And so I went just all out in preparation for my first DEF CON. I had never been. I didn't know what to expect. So I showed up at my first DEF CON and competed in what at the time was the TCP/IP Embedded Device Challenge, which is a contest that doesn't exist anymore. And it was run by a guy named Neural, who's kind of dropped out of the scene now, and I still give credit to him for basically changing the course of my life, because DEF CON has affected my life in ways that I can't even begin to explain or share in a public forum here, both including having met my wife there, as well as a couple other backstories. But I had built a skull with an embedded processor, and I had written a TCP/IP stack for it. And here I show up at DEF CON with my stupid little skull with the electronics in it. And I looked around at people that were competing in this contest, and I was the only one that was by myself. Everybody else was in teams, and I was like, crap, I am really in over my head. These are really smart people. Some of the best hackers in the world come here. I'm just going to look like a fool. And so I was really nervous, and I actually wound up winning that competition. And so my very first DEF CON, I won a black badge, and it was all downhill from there. I was hooked. It changed the course of my life. At that point,
we have to talk about the black badges, because the black badges are, well, they're the most coveted items at DEF CON. And quite simply, you win a black badge, you win one of the DEF CON contests, you win admission into the conference for the rest of your life.
Correct. But it's more than that. It's more the title. Because I don't really care about the, you know, $100 or whatever we're charging these days at the door. It was more of I had proven myself. And in order to get a black badge, you have to compete not in just any contest. It has to be a black badge contest, mm-hmm. which the determination of what contests are considered worthy of black badges is done by Jeff, DT. And, for example, last year we gave out 15 black badges and we had, 16 to 17,000 people there. So they're very rare in order to get them. And so you'll see people walking around the conference that have them. People who won black badges throughout the years will continue to wear them, the badge of the conference from years ago, because it's such a status symbol. Somebody took one of the black badges that I had designed that they had won and sold it, and it went on eBay for like $5,000 or something like that.
Which is really we you're not supposed to do that. I mean, the black badge, that is your personal badge of honor. It's not a monetary item.
Yeah, we weren't too happy about that, but they're non-transferable with the exception of the ones that we donated to Hackers for Charity for Johnny Long. Those we actually will honor, but for the others, you either use the badge yourself or, you know. Okay, so you bought a black badge. Does it really mean anything then? Not really.
Well, I think it would get you ridicule, because people would very quickly figure out that you did not win a black badge. You should not be wearing a black badge, and therefore they should just shun you.
Yeah.
Or make fun of you. It's going to happen. Okay, so we know that you took over the badges in 2011, correct?
Yeah, for Joe. Joe had done them for 5 years at that point.
Right. And Joe's badges were pretty elaborate, mostly hardware hacking badges. Yeah. There's still examples of them floating around the show. They're beautiful.
Yep, I still have my Joe badges, actually.
Yeah, I have like two of them, I think. I lost a couple in a move. I still have all of yours. But the wonderful thing about your design was you really combined art along with technology. And then you also integrated the crypto challenge. Do you want to talk a little bit about the mystery challenge? Because that was sort of the predecessor to what we do every year now.
So while Joe was doing the badges, I had mentioned that I had won a black badge my first year. I was determined I was going to win a black badge 3 years in a row. I was going to do a hat trick. But due to some other miscommunication, and I won't go into that story here, I actually wound up creating a contest that I thought was officially sponsored by DEF CON, and then at the last minute it was pulled out from under me. And I said, to hell with this, I'm going to do it anyway, it's going to go underground. And that's how the Mystery Challenge was born, actually, was I had put all this work into developing this contest, and then at the last minute, since support was pulled, I just went ahead and did it anyway. And it was probably the best blessing in disguise that has ever happened, because of the fact that I went underground with it. I got all kinds of support and interest in it, because geeks cannot stand to not know stuff. And so when I started posting on the DEF CON forums that I was running this mystery challenge, and instead of describing what the contest was, I described what skill sets might help you succeed. And in so doing, it sparked the interest of a lot of people, including Joe Grand, Bunny from MIT, a couple other guys. And a lot of them started talking trash to each other on the forums, not even knowing what the contest was. So, like, Joe was talking trash with some other people just for fun, nothing mean-spirited. But it was great fun for me to sit back and watch, you know, and here's Joe, the guy who's designing the badges, and I was just some unknown guy. And he was going to compete in my contest. So when that first year mystery challenge showed up, it was really me striving to bring everything that I considered to be part of hacking into a contest realm. Because at that point, CTF had turned into, in my opinion, basically who has the best reversers and who has the best tool set. And it represented one important aspect of hacking, but it missed so many other aspects of what I consider to be hacking. And so the mystery challenge pulled on everything from physical security to crypto to linguistics to puzzle solving, basically the full gamut of everything. And in fact, Romer, one of the goons, used to tell me that my contest was the most representative of what hacking is, more so than CTF, just because CTF was just one aspect. And so the mystery challenge just became wildly popular, and it grew each year. I had qualification rounds just like CTF. The people that competed in my challenge did as much work, if not more, than the CTF folks. And it blew up. And so for the 5 years that Joe was doing the badge, I was running the mystery challenge. And the mystery challenge had grown so much that at the time Joe decided he didn't want to do the badges anymore. That's why Jeff approached me and said, would you like to do the badges? And part of what I brought to the table with the badges is Joe's designs are great. Joe is a much better hardware designer than I am. I'm the first to admit that. But when you had the badge hacking contest, you had a very limited subset of the conference that was the people that had access to actually competing in that contest. And so here you had all these thousands of people with Joe's badges, but if you looked at the badge hacking contest, you had very few people actually competing in that contest because the bar for entry was so specific or high. And so what I tried to do was unlock the badge contest for everyone at the conference. So there was a little something for everybody. And by doing that, I accomplished two things. It gave everyone something to do, but at the same time, it also forced people to talk to each other. And that has always been one of the goals. Everything that I have ever done for DEF CON has been designed to bring people together, because it's no secret that we are a community of geeks, and a lot of us are introverts. I don't like to think of myself as an introvert, but I, you know, a lot of my geek friends are. And because of that, all of the stuff that I did was designed to help people come together. And you guys get to see my wife coming in the door with our daughter there. Interesting side DEF CON story. My wife and I actually met because she was actually solving the crypto in the mystery challenge so well that at one point, several different mystery challenge teams were Skyping her in a year that she didn't attend the conference. And the teams didn't each know that she was being a reference for them. And so the reason I bring that up is my better half actually is actually part of, we're more of a duo, but she doesn't like to be in the public eye. So I have to give credit to my wife for a lot of the stuff that we do. She is she's the one that helps with the artistic bent. I come up with zany ideas, and she helps me execute. So she's behind the scenes, but she's always there.
Lost, let's go ahead and show our audience a little bit of what we're talking about here. You just saw a video up on the screen of the latest badge. That's from DC23, and it was actually an LP, a full-on vinyl LP. That there was a mad. I don't think there was a used record player left in Las Vegas. I think every single one of them was bought out about 5 minutes after registration opened. But let's go back a little bit. Jason, I think you have the overhead. Here's a couple of badges from years past. This is from DC 2020. So these were propellers chipsets. That these badges, I actually love this idea. I'm not sure if you can see it, but there's a little IR sensor on the top of each one. And the way that it worked was you actually had to sync with other badges.
Yes, and I actually tuned the, and in code, we actually tuned the IR so that you had to be a particular distance away, because I didn't want people to do it from across the room. I wanted to cause people to interact with each other.
Let's see if I can get
and this. So not only did they sync, but you had to linger for a certain amount of time. So you couldn't just go past somebody. You had to actually stand in front of someone, and it caused people to start having conversations. Interestingly enough, the lanyards are as much a part of the contest every year as the badges. And if you notice, almost every year, I always put something right on the direct back of the lanyard where it is on the back of your neck. And that's because people not only then have to talk to you about your lanyard, but you have to take it off. And you have to pull it in, put it in your hands. And that also causes people to linger and have conversations, people that might not otherwise break out of their shell and talk to strangers that they had never met before.
Right. And then we went from that to DC-21, and this was an art badge. So there's no active electronics on this.
It's interesting, though, but it is a PCB.
Yes.
So those badges were designed in full-on EagleCAD, and I actually did it in the free version as a challenge to myself to see, could I do this in free software? And for those of you who are both artists and worked in things like Photoshop, and those of you who've done PCB design know, when I tell people, all of the art on those badges was done in PCB layout software, not art software. That is really the crowning achievement of those badges. And so they were produced in a circuit board PCB fab house, just like everything else. And the metal you see is the exposed copper for the pads. The coloring is the silk screen layer. And they are PCBs.
And one of the things that we've learned from doing the crypto challenge every year is everything, absolutely everything you see, from the symbols to the any sequences, including the decorations across the show itself, can be part of the crypto challenge, which I think is, again, that's what makes it so fun, because your best chance is to get yourself with a group of people, and it should be dissimilar people who will take different angles on something, because otherwise you might miss something.
Correct. In fact, I bait the contest every year. I do a couple things. I have to Google-proof my stuff. I have to make sure. I run everything that I do through Google instantly just to see what's going to come up. And most of the time, I will thread red herring tangents into the contest, knowing that the first place a lot of people are going to go is Google. Mm-hmm. And the intent on that is to frustrate people into thinking about the problem rather than just running to Google for every solution. I want to bring magic back into the world. I want magic and mystery to be a part of people's lives. And when I can just run to Google and see how every magic trick is ever done, it kind of ruins those things. So I intentionally Google-proof all of the stuff that I do. And ironically, really abused Google the year that I used the mistranslation of the Latin from Google Translate. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Oh, yeah.
But I put a lot of red herring tangents into the contest. Not to frustrate, but to help people have the opportunity to have those epiphanal moments. And it happens every year. This year at DEF CON in the 1057 room, I had guys that were just working on one part of the problem for hours and hours, and they were really frustrated and really pissed. And the minute they get it from across the room, they jump up, they high-five each other, and that moment of elation that they get from solving a very difficult problem that they've been working on, that's something that people don't get that often anymore. No. And that's really the payoff for me for all the hours of work, is when I see that type of thing happening. And then the birth of all these other contests. Several of the contests that happen at DEF CON now are former Mystery Challenge people. Crash and Compile is one of them. The Darknet folks were all former Mystery Challenge people. And so the Mystery Challenge kind of birthed all of these other tangents, because I've always told people always come up to me with ideas. And I'm like, you know, if you have an idea, do your own thing. Make your own contest. You know, we'll support you.
Now, I do want to talk a little bit about my personal favorite, DC-22. I loved this badge. I loved this challenge, partially because one of the easiest ways to solve one of the first segments of the crypto challenge was to go to movie night. If you went to movie night, you actually got a head start on a lot of the people who were trying to crack the contest. Now, when we connect this, if you go to my computer, Jason, one of the nice things about your computer badge years is that they all have an interface. I have to reset this one. And this allowed us – there we go – to actually receive a string of characters from the default firmware that was loaded onto these boards. Let me go ahead and start a connection. COM3.
Yeah, it's funny. So the DC-20 badge that you showed earlier had all the interfaces, because the goal was to make a badge that people would use after the contest was over as a dev kit. And so I was trying to put stuff in people's hands that they might not otherwise touch to give them a spark and interest in it. But the year that I did that, a lot, some people just dumped the firmware and pulled strings out. So for the one, for the DEF CON 22 badge, which you're holding in your hands, I actually encoded a lot of the strings in memory that decoded as they print out here on the terminal, like you're seeing. But I also put some plain text strings in. So if they dumped the firmware and looked at it, those strings were complete bogus. Didn't give a direction for where to go.
If I let this sit long enough, it will actually start spouting lines from John Carpenter's They Live, which is a horrible but fantastic horror movie from the 80s. And you do this a lot. This is one of the pieces of your challenge. You like to work in whatever it is that you're interested at the time into your challenge. I remember notes into a badge challenge. This one, were you on a John Carpenter kick? Was that the thing?
So my wife got really sick of hearing me play. If you've seen the movie They Live, you remember that the bass part? Ding, right. Ding, ding, ding. I was playing that on the bass over and over because while I watch the movie, I'm getting ideas for stuff I was going to do. Yeah, and I'm a big horror movie fan. You know, Lost Boys, The Handle, and I love really bad horror movies from the 80s. They Live was great, and it totally fit the hacker scene, too, for what had happened in the movie. And it also fit with what was going on politically at the time, and it just kind of fell into place.
Another element with this that particular year was you had this. So just like in They Live, there were special glasses that would allow you to see the aliens, the monsters, as they were. In order to complete this challenge, you had to take your DEF CON program guide, and there were a set of red glasses that were just included in your packet, no explanation. And if you look through the margins of the program, you would actually see messages that were part of the crypto challenge.
Yeah.
This, I mean, again, this is one of those things where, especially those first few minutes in the hardware hacking village, where there's a bunch of people who are just showing off what they found out. And you hear people who are so excited because they think they figured out part of Lost Crypto Challenge. And it may be a red herring, but at the same time, it's an exciting, exciting couple hours.
Yeah, it's gotten to the point now where this last year at DEF CON 23, so I always show up a week or two early to help set up and everything else to get all the stuff ready that I need to, because I plant stuff all over the contest. I had sent out a tweet of, I forget where we were, like in the conference copy center or something like that. And I sent out a tweet with a picture making fun of one of their security signs because they had shut down the terminals that were in their copy center because they knew all these hackers were coming. And so I thought it was funny, so I tweeted a picture about it. And less than 60 seconds later, some guy shows up in the room, and they were people that were competing in the contest that year. They had already staked out the entire hotel, and they had people at different checkpoints all over the hotel, and they recognized from the picture I tweeted where I was in the hotel. And they instantly found me. And this is before the conference has even started, and they recognized that I had lanyards with me. And so they came up, and we're trying to get a head start on everybody else. But it was a little freaky taking a picture, tweeting it out, and then some guy just shows up based on where I was in the hotel.
Well, people are serious about that challenge. You've had people break into your room a few times,
yes,
right? Looking for clues.
Most years I have multiple hotel rooms. I've had people hitchhike, the hacker term hitchhike, with the maids into my room. Basically, when the maid goes in to clean, they'll try and talk their way in to get into the room. I've had people social engineer my family. I get constant hacking attempts on my systems. I watch the logs all the time. It's actually quite entertaining. For most of the phone numbers that I give out in challenges, I use burner numbers that I keep a hold of. And to this day, I still get calls on several of those burner lines at just random times. Like I'll get a call probably once a week at this point from the ones from DEF CON 23. I get emails constantly, and my favorite thing is I get people still solving pieces of puzzles because I never take anything down. If it goes up online, I just leave it. And so I have basically, it's kind of like, you know, the junk satellites floating around the earth. My crypto puzzle pieces are all over the web, much like those junk satellites. And so I still, to this day, get a random solving of a piece of something that I've done, because somebody will stumble across it somehow on the web. And that happens at least once a week.
We're speaking with Lost Boy, Lost from DEF CON. If you've ever been to the show, or if you've know about anything from the DEF CON lore, you've heard about his work, you've heard about his art, and you've definitely heard about his crypto challenge. When we come back, we have a little bit of time left. We we want to ask Lost for some advice that he might want to give to a younger generation of tinkers, of hackers, of people who may be thinking about going to DEF CON for the first time. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the second sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. And it's a favorite of mine. Now, when you are on the internet, it helps to have a repository of knowledge, something that you could go to time and time again, both to find new skills and maybe to refresh skills that you may have forgotten. Well, that's what lynda.com is all about. lynda.com is the place to go for the curious, for the problem solvers, for the people who want to make things happen. Maybe you want to learn a new programming language or learn how to develop an app, maybe take better photos, sharpen your Photoshop skills, solder. Whatever it might be, lynda.com has everything you need to feed your curious mind. Right now, their new courses include a first look at C Sharp 6.0, up and running with ASP.NET 5, and the foundations of programming databases. They've also got an entire multi-part series on Visual Studio 2015. If you're interested in developing for the web, they've also added courses on up and running with PHP MyAdmin, SAS Essential Training, WordPress Essential Training, and up and running with Python and Django. With a lynda.com membership, you can watch and learn from top experts who are passionate about teaching. And this is high-quality audio and video. It's not that YouTube video. Not that there's anything wrong with a YouTube video, but you don't want to have to deal with shaky camera work or bad audio or bad lighting when you just want to get the material. And that's really what lynda.com gives you. You can stream thousands of video courses on demand and learn on your own schedule, on your own pace. And courses are structured so that you can watch them from start to finish or consume them in bite-sized pieces, including on your laptop, your desktop, your iOS device, your Android device. You could browse the course transcripts, which I personally find to be the best feature, because it means that if you need that reference, you're looking for an answer to one specific problem you're having, rather than having to watch an entire module, you jump to the part of the videos that answers that question, and you're ready to go. Now, you can create and save playlists of courses that you want to remember. You can share it with friends so they understand what you're working on. And most of all, you can just have the peace of mind of knowing that lynda.com will be there for any of your questions or your knowledge needs. Now, your lynda.com membership gives you unlimited access to training on hundreds of topics, all for one low flat rate. Whether you're looking to become an expert, you're passionate about a hobby, or you just want to learn something new, I want you to visit lynda.com/C101. That's lynda.com/C101 and sign up for your free 10-day trial. That's lynda, lynda.com/C101. And we thank lynda.com for their support of Coding 101. We're speaking with Lost Boy, the Lost Boy himself from DEF CON. He's been telling us about his journey into math, into crypto, into computer science, and ultimately into DEF CON. Now, but before we get into guru time, there is one question I wanted to ask you about this last year's DEF CON, because when I was in the hardware hacking village, as I was packing up all my stuff, one of the guys handed me a box and said, you know, hey, Padre, take this home. And I had no idea what it was. I threw it in the box. It wasn't until I got home that I realized that it actually, aside from a bunch of different components, it also had a radiation detector. And I didn't realize why until I had heard that you had made the Uber badges radioactive this year.
Yeah, that's correct. So I kind of do a personal homage to somebody every year with the Uber badge, and this year it was Richard Feynman, the physicist. So I had 6 different radioactive isotopes on each of the Uber badges this year. In fact, on my desk back here, I actually made myself a desk version, so the actual Ubers are upside down. But this is the desktop version that I made.
Wow.
So the base is a Lichtensphere. I don't know if you can see it in the camera work or not. But basically, it's etched lightning. So the acrylic is actually run through a particle accelerator and then forcibly discharged. And I don't know if you can see it in the camera or not.
I know there's trinitite in there somewhere, yes?
Yeah, so this is uranium-doped glass. So when the glass is in a molten state, uranium is added. I've got trinitite, and I've got tritium. I've got yellow cake. I've got uranium ore. So underneath each of these skulls, sorry about if the camera's not good enough to pick it up. So each one of those has a countersunk hole. If you look from the side, you can see it. And the ores are actually put in underneath. And so each badge actually has radioactive material in it. And some of that was taken from the test site that Feynman and Oppenheimer were at when they did the original test prior to the bombs in Japan. But it was so Feynman actually is the only person to watch the he watched with the naked eye everyone else wore the protective goggles. It's, you know, where the famous now I've become destroyer of worlds right. comment that you had from Oppenheimer. But in fact, I even wore a Feynman t-shirt on opening ceremonies at DEF CON this year.
Of course.
And, oh, so my personal favorite thing that happened this year. So on the back, every year the Uber badge has some type of code on it that carries through so that those that get the Uber badge have a challenge after they go home. And on the back of this one, and again, I don't know if you can see it or not, you see the Vulcan salute?
Oh, yeah. There, yeah, there it is.
So I actually tweeted a picture to William Shatner with the death of Leonard Nimoy this year. And I got everybody in the DEF CON 101 crowd to do the Live Long and Prosper. And we tweeted that picture to Shatner, and Shatner actually responded to us and said, Hacker Love, XOXO. And so it was kind of a neat thing that Shatner actually acknowledged us when we sent that Twitter pic to him.
I remember I was following that. I think you put achievement unlocked or something to that effect. Yeah. Yep. Okay, that's something off the bucket list. One last bit of trivia, and that is on every Uber badge that you make, we see the skull. There's always some sort of skull, some sort of stylized skull, and that's, of course, because your Uber badge came from your skull-embedded web server.
From that skull that I first originally built, yeah. So I have a couple things that I do that are tradition-wise. Like, I put a Rot 13 in every year somewhere, just as kitsch. Sometimes it's a little more complicated, and it may be the first step toward a more complicated decrypt. But Rot 13 is a functional part of the challenge at some point every single year.
Right.
Very cool, very cool. So, okay, lost guru time. So there are many, many people out there that want to know how they can get into CS or EE or crypto. What advice can you give to somebody who's looking to start in the tech field and to get into those fields?
So I got a couple of pieces of advice. I thought about this question and having taught at the university and everything else. Those of you guys that are still in school, take this advice for what it's worth. Whatever tech classes you take, by the time you graduate, they have a shelf life and that timer starts ticking. And there will come a time when someone's going to look at your resume and the certain things that you did, like the Fortran that you did in college or the Prolog that you did in college, if you take my meaning, is going to become obsolete. COBOL is not exactly in high demand right now. But math is timeless. Take as much math as you possibly can. Not only will that... not only does it transcend time as far as a skill set is concerned, but it's becoming more and more prominent with large data analysis and dealing with crunching large data sets and things like that. So do yourself a favor. Take as much math as you can stand. If you're not a math person, I understand. But but if you're a programmer, back yourself up with as much math as you can. As far as getting into security, it's interesting that DigitalOcean's one of your sponsors, because I was going to say, for the longest time, when I was a kid, I could tinker and play with systems and I didn't go to jail. And now we've got this generation of kids that are going to be afraid to do anything. They can't run scans. They can't do anything because they're going to get in trouble. They're going to go to jail. Well, then along comes this thing called virtualization, and now we've got hosts like you. You can do your droplets on DigitalOcean. Virtualization has changed that game. It's brought tinkering possibilities as far as security is concerned back into the realm of possibility. So if you're interested in security, spin up some VMs and break them, because, you know, it's a VM. What the hell do you care? You can roll back. And so having virtualization technology is an amazing opportunity for those that want to get into the security field. And it's something that basically, so my generation, we were kind of the young ones that had just started, but then you had a period of time where it was the, you can't do anything or you're going to go to jail because everyone's paranoid and nobody understands what you're doing except for a handful of people. And so they're going to legislate the heck out of stuff. You know, what is it from the movie Hackers? The Computer Fraud and Security Abuse Act of 1987, blah, 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 blah. So take advantage of virtualization and use that as a test or a playground. And it's amazing how much stuff is out there that's free and open source, videos that are all over the place, shows like this. You know, if you really want to get into it, I would say just ask yourself, is this what I'm passionate about? Because you really, at the end of the day, need to do something you're passionate about. If you're not passionate about it, like when I come home, I'm doing the same stuff that I do at work. I work for Intel right now. I'm part of the advanced programs group at Intel. And when I come home, I'm still doing tech-based stuff because it's what I enjoy. if you are doing a job that when you go home, you're like, man, thank goodness I'm not doing that anymore, you might be in the wrong field. And so consider that, because, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, money's nice, but do something that you enjoy and it's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, that's really great advice. So let's talk specifically in context of DEF CON. If someone wanted to take the leap and go for the first time, what advice would you give them, and where should they spend their time?
So I would invite anybody to come. I think it's a great conference. You're going to have the full gamut of people. For those that are new, starting Thursdays, we have basically what we call the DEF CON 101 track. Funny, this is coding 101. The DEF CON 101 track is kind of the exposure for new folks. And everyone's heard the horror stories about the things that you don't do at DEF CON. It's the same advice for any security conference. You know, just don't be stupid. Don't log into stuff on the public networks. Turn your Bluetooth off. Run VMs so that you can roll back. But get involved and talk to people. Don't do what I've seen a number of people do, which is bring a laptop and then sit in isolation. Because if you're going to do that, you might as well stay at home. Really, for me, what makes DEF CON what it is the interaction and the meeting of minds with other people. And that is, I think, the single greatest takeaway from going to DEF CON. Yes, the talks are great, but they're going to be online. You're going to be able to see videos of them. Go and stick your foot into the pool. Get used to talking to other people. Try your hand at a contest. We don't just have the CTF. We also have the Open CTF, which is, you know, if you want to go and play on that network, just break out of your shell. Talk to people.
Lost, we want to thank you so much for being part of this episode of Coding 101. And I want to close it off with a line of wisdom, just to remind people who are maybe not thinking about getting into tinkering, maybe not thinking about going to DEF CON this coming year, that you could sit at home and do absolutely nothing, and your name goes through like 17 computers a day. 1984, yeah, right, man. That's a typo. Orwell's here, just living large. We have no names. And for those of you who don't know that quote,
that's awesome.
You're going to find that out later on. Again, this has been so much fun. I only get to see you once a year, and so the fact that I can speak to you, that you could tell our audience a little bit about you, a little bit about the love for CS, the love for crypto, the love for technology, it just tickles my fancy.
And since this is Coding 101, can you tell some of these people, get off your kick and quit being afraid of assembly and learn some assembly?
Actually, we have that coming up. We've got Steve Gibson, who is promised to do an assembly module for our folks. And it's time for them to see what actually goes on under the hood. Yeah. You want foundational, you're not going to get more foundational than that.
The first time I broke a piece of hardware with code, it was an eye-opening day. When you can physically destroy something with software, that's power.
Absolutely. Lost, could you? I know that you've got everything going on, but could you tell the folks at home, if they wanted to find out more about what you do with DEF CON, what you do in the real world, where can they go to follow you, to see what you're up to, and to see what your challenges look like?
So I'm pretty active on Twitter these days. I don't even have a Facebook intentionally because of the nature of some of the work that I do. I do have a site, lostboy.net, which I update once a year maybe. I have a couple new projects that I'm actually launching this year. One is called The Mystery School, and I would say just watch out for that. I don't want to say too much about it because it's a mystery. But I guess the easiest way to follow what I'm up to at the time is probably Twitter.
Fantastic. And that's at 1057. Just go to Twitter, 1057.
Yep, and it's 1057,
right,
not 0.
1057. Lost, again, a pleasure. And I will say this. When you do come out of stealth mode and you want to show off your projects, you have an open invitation. I will get you onto one of my shows, be it This Week in Enterprise Tech, Know How, Coding 101, whatever it may be, because I love the work you do, and I think more people should know about it.
Thank you. I'm very flattered by that. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And, of course, big thanks to Lou Maresca. Lou, I don't know how you put up with us each and every single week, but we're better for having had you. Could you please tell the folks at home where they can find you and the work you do with Microsoft?
Absolutely. You can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. And, of course, as always, you can find me my work at Microsoft at crm.dynamics.com.
Folks, Thanks for joining us for this episode of Coding 101. Don't forget that we do this show every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. You can jump in at live.twit.tv and see us as we go. And as long as you're watching live, jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. It's a great way to give feedback. I've been watching the chat room this entire episode, and there is some just great conversation going on in there. You should be a part of it. Also, thanks to all the folks who make this show possible. Of course, to Lisa, to Leo, and to my TD today, who is filling in for many people who are either absent or with broken bones, Mr. Jason Howell. Jason, you're all over the Twit TV network. I don't know if you have a camera on yourself, but can you tell the folks where they can find you?
I have a camera on myself, but it appears to be very dim at the moment. twit.tv/AAA, all about Android. I'm just saying you might want to tune in tomorrow. We might have... Nexus devices right here, Nexus 5X and 6P.
Whatever.
Probably going to talk all about this tomorrow. twit.tv/AAA for that. Thanks.
Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, and that guy over on the screen over here is Mr. Lou Maresca. And Lou, how do we end each show?
End of line.